Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
I am your host, Brett King. You are with me. We are on the east coast of New York, in New York City, at the American Banker Source Media Studios. Thank you again, American Banker, for lending us your studio space. It's great to be collaborating with them. My co-host for today is Jason Henricks. Welcome back, Jace.
Welcome. Great to be here. And happy opening day for all the baseball fans out there.
Oh, I didn't know it was opening day for the baseball. Is that, like, does that, okay.
What do you do? Cricket? What's the Australian?
Cricket. They have cricket. They have rugby. They have Aussie rules football, which couldn't be different, more different to gridiron. Anyway, we'll get into that. Are you gonna talk about baseball's tie to fintech centers, or abandon that today?
No, not today. I'll let you slide on that one. Although I did catch quite a bit of flack from a lot of different geographies on Twitter about the fact that I didn't mention Atlanta, Austin, Nashville, Israel, the new initiative in Italy to create a fintech association, the Netherlands. Yeah, you name it, I heard about it. So evidently calling out geographies, not the thing to do on this show.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's get at it. Today what we have is Kristen Thierry from K&H talking about brand and currencies and private networks. We might have one of her colleagues join as well. On a closely related note to that, Duane Blomstrong is going to be on the show. She's going to be talking about her first book, her debut as an author, Emotional Banking. And finally, John Best is going to be on talking about Breaking Digital Gridlock, his new book that has just come out on Amazon and wherever good books are sold. So we've got a couple of authors on the show. Of course, last week we had Chris Skinner on previewing Digital Human. It was a really well-received show. We've had a lot of good feedback on that. So, we thought we'd try another couple of authors on the show again today. Don't forget that next month we have our big blockchain month. So have some amazing guests coming on for talking about blockchain. Dr. Craig Wright. We hope to get the Winklevoss twins on. We have Brock Pierce joining us. We have the team from Ripple joining us. It's going to be a massive blockchain month next month in April. So stay tuned for that. Now, coming up, a couple of conference announcements. We have the Flourish Branded Currency Conference in Chicago, April 9th. Is that right?
9th
through 10th?
Yep.
Through the 11th, right? And JP, you'll be keynoting there. Jason is hosting a fireside chat at the event. So, a couple of Breaking Banks Provoke hosts will be there. If you're a Provoke listener, you get a 20% discount. All you need to do is when you register, put in Provoke20 at flourishcon.com. And we'll be hearing from Kristen a little bit more about that in the segment to come. The Mobile Payments Conference early bird registration is open until April 30th. Provoke listeners save $200 when they register at mobilepaymentsconference.com using the code MPC18FIN. We did a fireside chat and a live episode of Breaking Banks at their last event last year with Jason and I did that, so good to see those guys coming back this year. Jason, what's in the news at the moment that you found of interest?
So much news to you. So David Balter and the team at Flipside in Boston just raised about $3.5 million from True Ventures this week. And what I find interesting actually isn't that I've known David for years and that he's moved into the crypto space, but it's the equivalent of algorithmic trading applied to crypto. So talk about buzzword bingo. It brings big data, AI, machine learning, all for cryptocurrency. And wondering if we're on the verge of just a whole mass of those moving into that space. In a related note on the trading front, CME Group is acquiring the London-based NEX in a deal worth close to £4 billion. And I just like to say pounds versus dollars, feels a lot heavier. And what I find interesting about that is now CME actually reaches all across the foreign exchange and currency value chain, not just the future and spot markets, which could be a very interesting play if they're looking at what blockchain could do now they own the entire settlement supply chain. Does that mean they're going to implement it? Or is this a defensive move in the face of future threats that they're consolidating in advance? You know, do you have something to add there, Brett?
No, I was just going to say Nex, for those that aren't familiar with, Nex is a UK-based business focused on electronic markets and post-trade business. So they are on the list on the London Stock Exchange, but they're not to be confused with the London Stock Exchange or the London Metal Exchange or the Mercantile Exchange or whatever. They are essentially a software platform business for exchanges.
Yep. Definitely. And so if you follow me on Twitter, you know that one of my pet peeves is at conferences when you hear Uber being referenced as a payments app that happens to run a car service. Like, nothing gets me more riled up than that, or the fact that Airbnb doesn't own any hotel rooms. However, they did just apply for an e-money license in the Netherlands this week. So I guess I'm going to have to start biting my tongue, because they may actually be a payments app. And this might be in part because of the success that Grab, their Southeast Asian competitor, has been having running a P2P payment app, doing microloans and insurance products for their drivers. It's a great example of what banks need to wake up to. When we say a better experience, it doesn't mean putting more digital lipstick on the pig, but fundamentally rewriting and embedding the idea of commerce and payments and banking into the broader experience. On a last note, there was an incredible piece in last week's American Banker where two bank CEOs that will remain nameless at least until you go find the article yourself, that said they're not worried about Amazon becoming a bank because it's too complicated and to be regulated. You know, Brett, I'm not sure that...
But they don't understand the threat, right? The threat isn't that Amazon's going to reinvent banking. The threat is Amazon has incredible distribution power, and they'll be able to acquire customers at, you know, a fraction of pennies on the dollar compared with traditional players. So the threat is to the distribution model. It's not the threat to the mechanics, the operational side of banking. If you don't get that, I don't know how else we can explain it. But if you look at Ant Financial, that's really what that's where they've moved the needle in China. Deposit taking, customer acquisition, that's what's been revolutionized by, you know, Alipay, Lufax, all those players. And that's where the banks now got incredible pressure to come up to that same standard of, that same economic model of distribution. Yep. And that same standard of fulfillment in terms of onboarding. So, and other news, we also saw HSBC is now offering PayPal as a global disbursement option for corporate clients. That's only taken, 20 years for HSBC to integrate PayPal. Yeah. This is the speed with which the incumbent industry moves, my friends.
Well, and what's interesting, remember, PayPal went to the banks in the first place and said, we should partner. And the banks
I was at a meeting with PayPal and HSBC in Hong Kong back in the mid-90s. It must have been 97, 98. And it was just like, why would we ever need to partner with you guys? So, anyway.
Well, and back to the experience mode for a second. So I needed to send my cousin some money over the weekend when we were at a family event. And he's a Zelle user. I'm a Zelle user. Thought this should be no problem, right? It took 3 attempts. The fact that I changed from his email address to sending it to his cell phone triggered a fraud alert. 24 minutes of phone time later, I gave up. And even though he wasn't a Venmo user, from start to finish, it took me less than 2 minutes to send him money and for him to set up the application on his side and receive it. You know, that's where the threat comes in of being a better experience.
Interesting. It's all about the friction. If you look at every fintech that is trying to do something in the world, or every technology company entering the financial services space, it's not that they want to reinvent what a banking license should be. They're reinventing access to the utility of financial services. That's sort of really core at it. So let's talk about branded currencies, cryptocurrencies, and payment networks. We'll invite at this point to join us, Kristen Thierry. Kristen, is Holly on with us as well, or is it just you today?
She should be on. Well, you got both of us, yeah.
Holly is on. Thanks for joining us, Holly. Okay, so you guys, I'll let you guys introduce yourselves, and then let's talk about what's coming up with the Brannig Currency Conference and so forth.
Sure. Well, this is Holly Glowati, and Kristen and I founded Flourish Conference last year, basically because we feel that this portion of the payments industry has a huge, there's a huge gap when it comes to other conferences. We're often overlooked because gift card sounds very small potatoes, as does loyalty, but it's really a much bigger industry than people realize. We estimate it to be about $400 billion. So that's why we're focused on it. And I'll let Kristen tell you a little bit about herself.
Yeah, so this is Kristen Thierry, as Holly mentioned, really launching the Flourish Conference last year out of that need. And we really want to make sure that we are defining what branded currency means. And that's, I think, part of the problem here is that there is no concise definition of what everybody thinks of when they think of branded currency. In our view, we view it as anything where there is a monetary value that is designated to a specific ecosystem. So oftentimes you think of gift cards in that ecosystem, but it also means loyalty points, coupons, referral codes and value, anything where there is a specific place where you can use that monetary value. So that's why we say we estimate it to be about $400 billion when you add all those things up. Gift cards itself is about $150 billion. So it is quite a large area that is often overlooked by some of these other conferences. So we are excited to be the ones to bring Flourish to the market and allow that space to talk about these opportunities and challenges specific to this niche.
Can you give me an example of a branded currency?
Absolutely.
Would you call the US dollar a branded currency?
Well, actually, yeah. When you think about that, that's a really good point, Brett. You certainly could, as you compare it to other, other in-country currencies, definitely. But when we view it as, specifically, mostly for brands. So Starbucks is really the darling of the industry. That's the example everybody turns to. When you think about the value that you load onto your Starbucks card and you use every single day, 40% of transactions at Starbucks now are being transacted via their mobile app on their gift card. So that's pretty amazing when you think about the consumer behavior shift that they've been able to instill in their customers' day-to-day actions. So that's really the darling of the industry. There are other brands who do it well. Also, but that's really the one that is sort of the beacon in our industry.
Okay.
So where else has the shift to digital impacted? Starbucks is a great example where they had to have looked at and said, wow, we pay an awful lot in interchange. Maybe, we could reduce that as well as increase loyalty at the same time. Are there other players that are making a big shift that aren't necessarily the darling of the industry?
Yeah, I would say one of my favorite examples is actually Red Robin, of all places. This year around holiday, they did their Year of Yum. So why I think this is so genius is they actually paid attention to their consumer behaviors. And a lot of retailers, I think we're all noticing this, haven't quite been doing that. So what you're seeing with Red Robin is you paid to have 12 $15 gift cards sent to your house, one a month. And basically, that means someone's going to step foot inside a brick and mortar Red Robin once a month to spend these gift cards. And when the average lift is somewhere between $30 and $35, I mean, Red Robin stands to make almost $4.5 million on this one promotion. They sold 10,000 of these and they sold out incredibly fast because they responded to what their consumers were doing. They weren't just saying, well, Starbucks does this, let's just do that. They right-sized the innovation for their company.
Right-sizing the innovation is a great example here. Are there others like Red Robin that are doing things like this that are very innovative without necessarily being, the Starbucks and the Amazons and the Googles and the Facebooks that we always talk about?
Well, there definitely are a lot who are starting to try this. It's interesting because One thing that we've noticed is there's a lot of retailers trying to hold on to sort of those old beacons. And I think, Brett, you had mentioned that credit cards, I think a couple of episodes ago, that credit cards had dropped something like 40% in adoption rate. And
So for millennials, it's at half the adoption rate of their predecessors.
Which is crazy. And so what we're seeing is those private label credit cards aren't doing as well. And so gift card is actually really growing. And so a lot of retailers are just starting to perk up and say, okay, prepaid is the way to go, because you're seeing a generation where they're debt averse. And so if you can prepay and really create these ways to budget for yourself, so it's not even necessarily the retailers who are causing a lot of the innovation, it's the behaviors in the consumers that are driving these products to be used in different ways.
Interesting.
What do you guys think about the whole ICO and token play in this respect? We know Starbucks has been talking about this as a potential, as have others.
It's interesting. I think retailers are too, they don't have the internal teams to build something like this. Your traditional retailers their IT teams are backlogged as it is. So it's going to have to be a fintech company who does it for them. We are going to have to partner, much like banks need to partner right now, with these fintech companies to help cause this innovation, because Kristen and I always say, every time we're listening to the podcast, you could swap the word bank out for retailer, and it's the same problems, different label. They can't innovate as quickly as they need to, unless you are the Amazons and the Starbucks of the world, where you did build that internal tech team.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the swap, because right now there's a personnel swap going on that a lot of the retailers are actually plucking people out of the financial service world. Some of the most innovative people within financial services are now finding themselves at the retailers. You know, the person who built out the Starbucks payment network and all of their digital strategy is actually now at J.Crew. So I'm pretty interested to see what they do. Not that I need to shortcut the line when I'm ordering something from J.Crew, but there certainly is something to be said for embedding the transaction in the commerce play together at the same time.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's kind of exciting when you think about it, because we're going to see this complete revolution in retail. I mean, when everyone is so digital first, we're actually talking with one of our speakers this morning, Bridget Brennan, and she was like, we're constantly shopping. I mean, Pinterest. I mean, I'm constantly creating a list of things I'm going to be shopping for at some point. So when you're constantly shopping and everything is so immediate, what can someone do at brick and mortar? What can you do to bring that easy, frictionless, like you were saying, experience?
Yeah. Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about the conference coming up? Holly had mentioned the speakers who are going to be there. Who else can we expect to hear from, and what will we learn at Flourish other than getting to see JP and my bright, shining faces?
Absolutely. We are very excited for Bridget. But one of the things we're also really excited about, actually, Jason, you will be hosting a live podcast on stage for the first time ever at Flourish with Mark Schatz, the president of Global Gift Card from Stored Value, SVS, on the industry consumer insights and how to help retailers really drive that stored value innovation. So we're really excited about that session in particular. And then JP will be kicking off our day two with a keynote discussing innovation and disruption. So we're really excited for those two sessions, but we are covering themes from going global, how to really take your product digital, still how to manage that at point of sale and physical point of sale, as well as online point of sale, and then any B2B trends, because that's also really important for our industry. So lots of great themes, great speakers. We've got about over 60 speakers in our lineup this year. So that's a really great growth from last year. We're really excited. The conference is April 9th through 11th. Most of the content is specifically on that Tuesday and Wednesday, the 10th and the 11th. So we certainly hope people can join us. It's at the Hyatt Centric Mag Mile downtown in Chicago, and it should be a great time. Have by all.
And how can people find out more about the conference or register for it?
Yep, they can go to flourishcon.com. and find out all the information, registrations on there, our speakers, our agenda, everything they need to know is on the website.
Comic Con started that, didn't they? The con thing, right?
They did.
Flourish Con.
Yeah.
FlourishCon, fantastic. Well, thank you, Holly and Kristen, for joining us. And when we talk about these branded currencies and private networks, you know, those are really strategic moves to build loyalty and emotional connection with customers. So we're pleased to have on the show our frequent guest and friend, Duane Blomstrom, to talk about emotional banking, the subject of her new book, Emotional Banking, Fixing Culture, Leveraging FinTech, and Transforming Retail Banks into Brands. That is not a short title, by the way, Duane.
Well, you can just call it emotional banking, though, right?
I want to thank you for the full subtitle.
Well, I'm out of breath, and I'm sure you can find it at Amazon, and if you can find a brick-and-mortar bookstore still, it's probably there, too. And, you know, Duane, I know you, Ron, Jim, and I had quite the debate on Twitter last week about, you know, can banks actually build emotional connections other than frustration with their customers? Before we jump into that rabbit hole, though, can you share with our listeners what your thesis was behind the book?
Yes, of course. And thank you for having me, guys.
And while you're doing that, why it's got a heart on the cover, that's what I would really like to know. I've been thinking about that all morning, but no, I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, I'm sure you've been thinking about the book all morning, but I start with
why. I do my prep, Duane. I do my prep, you know.
I start with why it has a heart on the cover. It's because I didn't think that bankers would necessarily pick it up if it had anything else. No, I do want them to start feeling uncomfortable from the second they pick it up in the brick and mortar shops and start realizing that we're going to be talking about the uncomfortable topic of feelings. That's why we chose that cover. And I have an amazing publisher who kind of worked with me on what we're trying to accomplish with it. Plus, it stands out. I think it's pretty. So there you go. On the other real question, Jason, what was it exactly? How did we come up with this? Well, that's a loaded one. So I've been in this industry for a while now, a few years. And on this journey of mine, I realized at some point that I came up with this concept of emotional banking that was essentially looking at why is it that banks don't think about the consumer's feelings. So I went to investigate that. I started on the long road of holding various consultations with banks and doing workshops and asking them the right questions and figuring it out. Very soon it became apparent that they're just not thinking of themselves as a brand. They don't have that type of connection with their clients. They make products. They don't make money moments, as I call them. They make they deliver something. They don't really have an addictive experience, a goal in mind, and so on. Investigating this further and why they're not brands, and I have to disagree with what the lady said earlier. You can absolutely not swap banks with retailers. Retailers have spent an amazing amount of time attempting to think of their consumer. Not any of that has happened in banking. So in an effort to change that fast, I knew it wasn't about the technology and everything we have in fintech was going to help them once they knew what to do with it. I knew these banks needed to become design-led organizations yesterday. I just didn't think that they had the capacity of doing so without going through a major cultural transformation. So I ended up in a place where I realized I have to start building a cultural transformation method. So the reason the title is longer than it is, and thank you for saying it, is because if nothing else, then I need people to remember that you're not going to be getting to use fintech unless you fix your culture.
Well, so, you know, a lot of banks, you talk about this at the start, you talk about these shifts that are happening in the industry. One of the things I found interesting is you debate, what is fintech? You take umbrage at the definition, for example, that Wikipedia has, that fintech is new technologies and startups, and you basically say anything that's technology, that's happening in financial services could be rightly classified as fintech. And you say that's not really the point. The point is about what that technology allows you to do for the brand. Would that be a right way to classify it?
Right. I think it's a combination between banks are not brands, and they should be. They don't think of their consumer in the same way. And more importantly, they seem to be fixated on the idea of technology, which, yes, you're right. I have a much broader definition. I think anything that empowers financial services through technology is fintech, whether that's made by a bank, a fintech company, or someone else. My thesis is none of this technology and wonderful ways of work and all the goodness of everything we're getting every day from a digital standpoint is going to arrive anywhere until these banks are going to completely change the way they think of their consumers, start looking at very deep and uncomfortable levers of change, and then apply those in a fast method, in the hopes of retaining the relationship with the consumer.
So, you know, it's interesting we bring up this whole idea of connectivity and lack of kind of heart in the industry. But, you know, when we talk to banks all the time, this comes up and you say, what's your competitive advantage? And they always answer, I shouldn't say always, but 99% of the time, the answer is our relationship with our customer, right? And then think, well, that's interesting.
But banks have got an ordinary relationship with customers, banks do.
That's where I was going to go with this, Brett, is so given that the banks today think that their competitive advantage is relationship, how is technology going to make that better for them? Because I don't know that our industry is one that's known for our technological prowess.
Right. I don't, for the record, believe that technology is going to make that better for them. That's not what's going to change. What they need in order to change, and you've heard this thesis before over the last few months, thankfully, is to change people, not to employ technology. The reason they believe they have a relationship is very simple. There has been little to no switching and little to no alternative. However, all of that is changing very, very rapidly. They can tell that's the case. The articles you were quoting earlier of CXOs of various banks coming out and saying they're not scared are not necessarily correct. I mean, these people are finally waking up to the fact that something needs to change fast to retain the relationship, whether it's neobanks or GAFAs or neo-GAFAs or anybody else. These people, those other people, know how to build a brand. They care deeply about their consumer. They have an internal culture that allows them to move fast, and they have the right technology. So, you know, the relationship doesn't exist. The whether or not banks have had a syndrome, Stockholm syndrome with their existing captive audience, that's debatable.
Would you say that, you know, in your example, would you say Amazon or Netflix or Google, would you say they have emotional brands? They have an emotional connection with customers?
Good thing that you mentioned Netflix. I was just going to write about it next week. I think they're building an astounding amount of data on behavior of their consumers while they're building content, while they're building a heart connection. So they could very well become a problem for anyone. I believe anybody, you know, from my beloved Ted Baker to one of the bigger guys, can and should and is going to become involved in the money moments we have. When they do and the connection is stronger, I see no reason to ever be returning to HSBC if I can bank through Ted Baker.
Hmm. Who do you think's done the best job on this emotional connection? I'd say, dude, easy to point
within banking.
Within banking, right? Because ING, I think, nailed this. But, of course, now they're part of Capital One. And I do think Capital One's done an admirable job of keeping that alive, that you do have those money moments. That I love that phrase from you, Duana. Who else do you think is doing it well?
And I can't mention any challengers?
Yeah. Sure. We love mentioning challenges on the space.
You know what I'm going to be saying. So I think that I knowing the product really well, I think you know the new propositions have done very well. Historically, simple is still a model of actually thinking of your consumers. Morven has done incredibly well, of course, lately. And I also think in terms of like over there in America. I also think over here in Europe, I would say they're the banks that have been serious about doing some internal thinking and transformation, some of which I've had the privilege to work with, your Nationwides, your in England, your sometimes smaller, medium outfits, but they have had the luxury of having the right team with the heart in the right place, with passion, knowledge, who will kind of drive them towards the consumer.
Well, I want to push on this simple thing for a second, because I think Simple did a phenomenal job at fixing the user interface. But I would also say they didn't go far enough to create what you describe as that money moment and that emotional connectivity. And I think that's one of the other challenges we still see in the industry for the incumbents is we're playing catch up. You know, the amount of time we talk about digital strategy and we need to be better at digital, but that's very different than the emotional connection that you're talking about. I think brand is deeper than digital. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Banks need to go back to the real drawing board. They need to scrap the product, think, how do I drive this money moment with my consumer and how do I make my consumer fall in love with me? But they can't do that thinking until they look at themselves, they grow some passion, they grow some knowledge, and they grow some courage.
But to your point, those money moments are increasingly delivered through a technology layer, not through traditional mechanisms that banks are comfortable with.
That's very true, yes. And I think evidently this entire battle is going to be at a digital level. And there's so many examples of really well-delivered experiences that are digital, from the Disney's to any other one that you want to mention. There's no reason for banks not to be matching those. And I'm not talking about matching like Jason put it. It shouldn't be playing catch-up. It should be scrapping and redesigning.
So digital is necessary but not sufficient. The true heart of this is, I loved your comment, they need to find passion, and that passion better be about the customers.
That's right.
Hey, listen, Jason and Duane, we're just coming up to a break. So what I want to do, Duane, is I want to come back, and after the break, I want to talk about sort of the call to action or the plan. How do you build that culture? What are the methods that you identified in your book to transition to become an emotional brand in the banking space? So we'll get to that after the break, if that's okay. All right? Stick around. For those of you that are keeping watch, this is Breaking Banks. Join us on Twitter if you want to have. If you've got some questions for Duane or John Best, who's coming up after Duane, if you've got some questions you'd like to pitch at them, don't forget you can just tweet it at Breaking Banks. Tweet us at Breaking Banks One, or myself at Brett King, or at Jason Henricks, and we'll be happy to put your question on the air, that'll be pretty cool. But just in the weird news before we go off to break, did you see the two New Jersey city cops who were accused of roughing up a Domino's pizza manager because they missed a delivery? That sounds to me like a pretty good excuse for roughing up a pizza delivery manager, right?
Yeah, I'm just trying to connect that back to fintech right now. But I'm
thinking, it's just weird news before we get to the break.
Yeah. So when Domino's does its ICO, we'll bring it up again.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, you're listening to Breaking Banks. You're here with Jason Henricks and Brett King. We're hosting. We'll be back right after these short messages from our sponsor.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
We'll be right back.
listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
You are back with Breaking Banks. I am Brett King, your host, and with me co-hosting today is Jason Hendricks from Provoke Media and also the host of FinTech 5. So, Jason, you know, have you had any interesting FinTech 5 interviews recently?
So I had a great interview yesterday that'll be up early next week, and it actually speaks to one of the things that Duana brought up about passion, because this is a billion-dollar bank that has a massive passion around using technology and innovation to better serve underserved and be more inclusive. And I loved one of the quotes from Dave Riley of Sunrise Banks, talks about banks need to quit being male, pale, and stale. And, you know, I wasn't going to bring it up on the show being pale, male, and probably stale, but it does definitely speak to, you know, what Duana was talking about is getting the passion back and that passion being about the customer.
Well, talking about male and pale, but definitely not stale, we should give a shout out to our good friend Jim Morales, who has turned 36 today, I think. Is that right, Jason?
Happy birthday.
Oh, yeah.
He was going to make a guest appearance on the show, but apparently he got caught on a flight that was delayed because Donald Trump decided to visit his airport or something. So he was disrupted.
Jim got disrupted. Concert, right?
No, he's going to Bruce Springsteen concerts in New York. So Jim, I know you're probably not listening because you're probably in the air unless you got in flight, and he's listening. But shout out from the team at Breaking Banks, Provoke Management, and Provoke Media to our favorite. What do we call him? Publisher, thought leader. I don't know.
The man with all the stats, and I'd say we'd sing happy birthday to him, except our listenership would just plummet. That would probably be
yes,
the end of Provoke.
Exactly. All right. So, Duana, coming back to emotional banking and the work you did on the book, you know, you obviously have come to this as an advisor or consultant in the space. So when you come in and, you know, you get a CEO or an exec team that gets it, that understands that they have this gap in terms of their ability to connect with their customers emotionally, what's the plan of action? You know, give us the 10-step plan or the 5-step plan or whatever it is to fix the gap.
Right. I was very lucky, I have to say. So over these 3 years that I've built the method and written the book, I've met really cool teams in really good banks that let me test a little bit to see what works. Because my pitch to these people has been, look, we have a problem. This is the gap, as you put it. The reason they understood it is because instead of saying, so we have to start a transformational process that's going to take you 25 years, instead of that, I was aiming to create something that would turn the ship around real fast. So my goal was to find that type of a lever that would change the way that they're doing things and inject passion, inject courage, change the way they use language, increase their knowledge. So with the help of 3 or 4 banks some of them, one of them, and I announced this earlier this week, one of my ex-clients, one of these bankers that understood, was Dr. Giulia Foredi, who was a senior VP in a very big international bank in Europe. I don't know if I can tell you what it is, but she understood. She was one of my clients. We developed a couple of the workshops together, and she has very recently joined emotional banking, so she believes that it works. So essentially what I came up with is not a 10-step detox program, although that sounds good. I should probably think about that, but more of a series of workshops that work. One of them, for instance, is called Everyone's a Designer Workshop. or the Build a Voice program that aims to take executives and insert them into the fintech conversation, or the Intrapreneur Factory program, which, by the way, there's a chapter about each of these methods in the book. And in the one about intrapreneurship, I was lucky enough to have JP write quite a bit of it. And also, maybe the most important one, the Keep It Real program, which ensures that bankers keep doing these things and they keep speaking English to each other.
What does that mean? What does Keep It Real mean in the context of this?
It starts with a workshop, which, you know, including all kinds of stuff, including a little bit of a swear workshop. So it's a little bit cutesy, it's gamey, it gets people in the mood to start communicating. And then we start looking at why language is so central to everything they're doing. So we're trying to train people who have been speaking business speak and consultancy speak to now talk to each other, communicate, be real in what they're actually attempting to say. And it starts with that workshop, and then it continues with methods, including a no BS button that a bank has introduced on their intranet as a result of the program. So there are a number of things that I believe are going to make a change fast. And I see, I mean, I don't have exact ROIs. I can't tell any bank, look, do this thing, and then in 10 years, you're going to make another 100 million. We don't have that kind of time. We need to make some changes quickly. And I see those changes in the industry already. People that went through the Build a Voice program are still present in the conversation. They're amongst us. People who were in the Keep It Real program are going to speak a lot more English, and you might hear the occasional swear word, but they're going to communicate. So I see passion in these people that I've worked with, and I see that they're more honest in their language, and there's a lot more knowledge for sure, and they're a lot more courageous, which is all we can hope out of bankers, to empower them to use technology.
So I do have a question from the Twitter feed, Duana, for you. It's from a good pal, Alex Jimenez. He says, why should banks bother to think about emotional banking when customers see banking as a nuisance that has to be dealt with?
Isn't Alex a banker? Why has he not seen that valuable relationship that banks have with their customers?
Well, yeah, so... I guess, you know, he's an ultimate cynic working in the industry. So how do you change that? How do you change the fit of banking in people's lives from right. being a nuisance that you have to live with because it's the only way you can, you know, move money around the place, to something that you can feel happy
about? Right, that you like, that you care about. I mean, we all have preferences. We have cars we drive, clothes we own, but you're not going to hear anyone defining themselves as banking with HSBC. That should be able to be changeable. It's a big deal who you put your money with and who you choose to give your half of your life to should be a big deal, should be definitory. I think it can be changed. I think they need to find a way to engage that type of an addictive experience and create that type of an addictive experience. And it's doable. Has it been? I mean, how come Disney could do it? How come JetBlue could do it? It's doable. It just needs rethinking with first principles in mind from a design perspective. And you can only do that if you have enough passion and knowledge.
Well, thanks to Alex for chiming in the Twitterverse and giving us a question for Duana. Listen, Duana. Let's. I do want to give John a bit of time here. So, sorry about the confusion, but let's transition to John. But before we do that, you mentioned Wiley's the publisher for you guys. Where can people find Emotional Banking?
Not at all. Palgrave Macmillan is my publisher.
Sorry.
That's all right. I just want the right people to get the money. So they can either buy it from Amazon, or as I said earlier today on another podcast, let's not give Amazon even more money. They can go straight to Palgrave Macmillan and get it from the website. Just put in my name or go to my website, which is DuanaBlomstrom.com, or even to emotionalbanking.com. Thanks so much, guys.
No worries. Okay, John.
Yes.
So you're in Colorado Springs, I believe, right?
Yes, I am. I'm out here, and actually today I'm coming to you from Denver. So I'm actually located.
Are you in Denver today?
Yes. I'm in Denver. One of my partners here was just having a big giant blockchain meeting here, and stepped out to join your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Was it a blockchain V1 or a SegWit blockchain meeting?
Well, it's actually neither. It's a Hashgraph identity meeting, but similar.
Well, there you go. So Tangles.
Does that make it a block party if it's a blockchain? Never mind. Let's move on to the book. Let's move on to the book, John. And before Brett had rejoined us, I just asked a little bit. Why don't you share before we run out of time the central thesis? Because I've really enjoyed what I've read so far. Would love for you to share, you know, more about it, and especially like because you work with so many incumbent financial institutions. What was the genesis of the book?
Yeah, the genesis of the book was when you get out of the industry. I was a senior vice president of a large credit union, which, by the way, I think does a great job of emotional banking, which is Westcom out in California. And, you know, when I was there, it felt like such a struggle. I felt like I was in gridlock, you know, projects that took time. Even though we were really good at it, it still felt like we had a long way to go. And what I realized when I got out of the industry and started doing consulting was, just like anything else, when you get outside, you can see things so clearly. And there were so many things that became so clear to me, similar to Duana's point, that there were conflicts that had nothing to do with technology. There were things that just had nothing to do with, the overall state of the organization, whether it be a community bank or a credit union. It was really just fundamental, almost therapy things. And so I broke the book down into people, process, culture, technology, security, and strategy. And the reason I did that was because every one of those had to be addressed in order to sort of create this. And so the final genesis of the book was this. You know, for years when I worked at Westcom Credit Union, we had a CUSO that we created home banking and mobile banking platforms for people. And they would get the product and they would want sort of the same success that they saw from, you know, that Westcom was getting. Yet they weren't getting it. And that's when it hit me that digital isn't a product, it's not a person, it's not a department, it's a discipline. It's no different than accounting, it's no different than lending. But we treat it as a product, we treat it as a person, we treat it as a sidebar thing. And that's why we get into trouble.
Yeah. Those silos, right? I love this, that it is a discipline. But if it's not a discipline that the majority of institutions have today, and you're particularly focused on credit unions and community banks, how do they learn digital as a competency?
You know, I think it starts with experiential, right? So there's a lot of organizations that want to go out and, hey, we'll go buy a digital fintech company and kind of try to jam that in our culture, only to have a failure there. I think that they've got to work on the digital strategy, and that strategy has to relate to their real strategy, right? So whatever island they want to sail to, whether it be the service island or the island of sales or the island of, you know, ultimate customer experience, whatever it is they're trying to be, once they have that and they know where they're trying to go, they've got to engage with the organization to create a strategy to build a boat that they can sail there with. And not only that, but to stay there and colonize it.
So many analogies and cliches in that statement. But,
from a man who's in the center of the country, by the way. Not an ocean in sight. He's sailing away.
Yeah, I grew up in Tampa, so.
Jason, I'll ask you a question. What do John, myself, and Elon Musk have in common?
Well, I was about to go with hair, but that's not true. Cause last I checked, Elon has pretty good hair. Was that unfair? No? Too much?
No. So do you know what I'm referring to, John?
My first podcast was about hair with Brett, so.
Do you know what I'm referring to, John?
I absolutely do, yes.
We all started our career on?
Commodore VIC-20s.
Yeah. Started our technology path learning to code on Commodore VIC-20s. So that's what we're in the VIC-20 club, the three of us.
Yeah. Wrote my first programs when I was very young.
Yeah, so the reason I bring that up is that essentially, you know, John comes at this in much the way that many of us frustrated technologists do, you know, with a deep commitment to the technology and having been involved in that. So it's interesting that what you inevitably came up with is a book about roadblocks. So do you think that part of the ability for banks to adapt is purely just that there are significant roadblocks in the way of technology adoption, John?
Oh, absolutely. And that's kind of what I pointed out. You know, there's so many issues that they have. I call it phase two syndrome. This is the process of organizations who say, hey, we're going to switch technology. They get the new technology out there, and it turns out it's just in parity with what the previous technology is. And someday, when they implement phase two, they'll get all the new features that came with that, but then they realize that phase two never happens. And they don't understand it, whereas a fintech company or even a an Amazon or a Google who's really kind of, delved into continuous improvement, continuous process, they don't have those problems. But the challenge is you're trying to take a van and take it out on the racetrack and try to win. You've got to change your thinking, and you've got to re-outfit people, thinking, culture, the whole nine yards to get everybody involved in that continuous improvement.
Culture eats strategy for breakfast, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Who's that? Is that Satya? I think it was.
I think it was Drucker.
Yeah, it's Drucker. Yeah. It's interesting because you bring up that aspect, and what's the competitive advantage of a startup in a fintech? I'd say part of it is desperation, right? Which is they need to go figure out how they can get customers and build a business model before they're out of business.
Before they run out of cash. A lot of it is how they can raise the next round, Jason,
Exactly.
And acquiring customers is obviously a key to that.
Yeah.
Well, and the other sense of it is that I find that financial institutions, like you're saying, have lost the hunger. And so they've become riskophobic. Their first answer to everything is no. And unfortunately, you can, you can say no to yourself right out of business at this point.
Yeah, that's the land of compliance, the land of no.
Yeah, well, but they rule.
Well, not just compliance, although, they do tend to be the business prevention department. When is the last time that you've seen the CEO of a bank or credit union celebrate one of their failures? And if we're going to do something new and risky, we're going to have failures. So how do we build that culture?
Yeah, I think Zuckerberg's celebrating failure this week, isn't he?
Well, it's funny because I actually talk exactly about that. Google has an entire division that when they get something to fail, they celebrate it. It's a moonshot division that, they talk about. There are actually clubs now. I don't want to curse on the web here, but they're, called the F-Up clubs, that where people get together and talk about their failures. But the problem with most financial institutions is they've confused failure and incompetency, So failure is, hey, we thought it would do X. It did Y. Now it's time to pivot. Incompetency is, we didn't think it would do anything. We weren't sure. We just kind of flew off the seat of our pants and did this, and it caused a problem. But for some reason, that's become one and the same, and it's completely intolerable at most financial institutions.
Jason, let me jump in here. One of the things I'm hot on in respect to the future of ability to execute revenue is around identity. And so you tackle this in, you tackle sort of the technology architectures required to evolve this sort of stuff, to be able to execute this. But, how would you describe the problem of, digitally onboarding a customer and what the roadblocks that you have to get over might be around that?
Yeah, so we're horrible at KYC. In terms of digitally, we're horrible at AML digitally. We don't really have a good process that doesn't require you to, give blood or lick the screen along the way, right? And that's because someone in the compliance department who has suffered a failure that was confused for incompetency got a wound and made a vow. And they were kind of like, as God is my witness, I will never let this happen again. And now that person is standing pat when you're trying to reduce friction in this process. The other challenge is that all of these identities are throwaway. You create an identity at Amazon, it's gone. It's only useful at Amazon. The ones that aren't throwaway, Google, LinkedIn, those kinds of things, unfortunately, they're mining your data and they're creating a privacy issue. So what the opportunity for financial institutions in the identity space is, what did Google do for you? Did they check your license when you signed up, Brett?
No.
No. So for another nickel,
ask for a utility bill. They didn't ask for my social security number.
You didn't have to go into your Google branch and show them your license.
No, I didn't have to sign a piece of paper.
Right, and so that identity is fairly useless in the sense of from a banking perspective. And what's the first thing you have to do with every service you have in banking? It's
you have to jump through identify them.
Yeah. Right. Well, and give you a lot of sensitive information right up front.
Right. And not only that, but we're horrible at it. And on top of that, people like Equifax have made it harder, right? So what we used to do was ask you, well, gee, Brett, have you ever lived at any of these addresses? Or of these numbers, which is the closest to your mortgage? All that data got stolen. So what do we do now, right? Well, what we do now is we go away from passwords. Passwords, by the way, 26% of most call centers' calls are passwords. If we stopped having a password, so imagine this experience, Brett. You're sitting here right now, your phone pops up, and it says, Wells Fargo is about to issue you a new credit card. Do you accept this? So we're looking for consent from you. Now, are you on the phone with Wells Fargo right now? Absolutely not. So you're going to do something that we've never had before. You're going to say, no, that's not me.
Yeah.
And once you deny that, think of the Wells Fargo problem that we had, right? They failed in consent, they failed in notification, and they failed in audit. All three of these things could be solved with identity. So it's a very powerful opportunity in the space. And, you know, as we grow into it, I believe that it's a new model for the banking industry to provide trust, to provide value, and to provide opportunity. That's why I wrote a chapter on sovereign identity, or self-sovereign identity, now known as SSI. Next week, I'll actually be at the Internet Identity Workshop. I don't know if you guys know this, but there have been people working on identity like it's secure for cancer for like the last million years. And they all meet out in Silicon Valley.
We are running out of time, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry.
It's a great stuff. No, you were going with the flow, but unlike the podcast, we got to finish on the dot because they turn us off on the air on AM and for the news. So don't forget, coming up in April is our big blockchain month. We're going to be talking about crypto and what's happening in the blockchain and crypto space. It's going to be very exciting. Tons of interesting guests, and so stay tuned for that. John, can we get your book?
You can go to breakingdigitalgridlock.com, and there's a link there to Amazon or any other place that you want to get it if you're a Kobo person. Also, you can go to jsbjr.digital, or you can go to bigfintechmedia.com, or you can hit me on Twitter at jbfintech.
In close, I just want to point out Pythagoras Pizza is doing the ICO around pizza delivery. There you have it. It's infiltrated everything.
Do me one favor, guys. If you've listened to Breaking Banks and you listen to us regularly, do me a favor. Do two things. Share the Breaking Banks episode that you most love this year with one of your friends. Get them to listen to it. And leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get access to your Breaking Banks. That's it for this week. Thanks, all the guests, for joining us today. Thanks, Jason, for co-hosting with me. We will see you guys next Thursday on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.